Welcome to the Martian Drive-In podcast number 45. My name is Terry Frost, and this time around I'm looking at a couple of episodes of the TV series The Outer Limits. Both of them were written by Harlan Ellison, and they are both very good. First off, we're looking at Soldier, starring Michael Anzara and Lloyd Nolan, and then to the classic Demon with a Glass Hand, starring Robert Culp and Arlene Martel. So it should be a bit of fun. It's a bit different, so sit back. I'll get the contact details out of the way, and we'll get on with the show. The Martian Drive-In podcast appears every 2 weeks and is a podcast of science fiction, horror, and fantasy movie appreciation. It doesn't matter what it is. It could be all the way from George Méliès through to Michael Bay, though I'm not likely to do Michael Bay. But feedback is important to me. So if you want to leave some feedback, you can leave it at cultguru, K-U-L-T-G-U-R-U, at gmail.com. You can leave it at the Martian Drive-In podcast website, marsdrivein.blogspot.com. The other thing you can do is go over to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. So if you type in Paleo-Cinema Cafe into Facebook, you can go and leave some feedback there as well. Now, there are occasionally adult concepts in this podcast, so just keep that in mind as you listen, and sit back and enjoy the rest of the show. Okay, how is everybody? We're doing fine here. Sal and I have just returned from Sydney, where I gave away my sister at a clifftop wedding above Maroubra Beach. It was a great time. We had about a week up there, visited family, and just caught up with a whole bunch of very cool people. I got to ride from the hotel to the wedding in a vintage 1960s combi van, which were the limousines that were being used for the wedding. And that too was kind of cool, cruising through Coogee Beach and other areas in the eastern suburbs of Sydney with people waving at us and bipping car horns and having a good time with that. My sister Linda was beautiful at the wedding. It was really great to hand her over to Gavin, her new husband. Their son Billy, who is 4 and a half, nearly 5, was running around like a mad kid all through the wedding and at the reception as well. Food at the reception was great. Caught up with my mother, caught up with Gav's mother Faye, and also my niece Catherine and my other niece Tamsin. So it was really groovy to catch up with them after so many years, and visiting my old hometown of Sydney. Did also get to do all of the usual Sydney rituals, like visiting Harry's Cafe de Wheels for a meat pie and going to Gould's Book Warehouse for a few second-hand books. So, yeah, it was very, very busy, though. Sal got a little unwell, so I did the drive on the way back. We ended up driving about 1,200 kilometres because we took the coast road, and we stopped at a little town on the east coast of Victoria called Mallacoota, which is the easternmost town in Victoria. Stayed there overnight, had some really good food there, and then drove back. But because Sal's caught the flu, I ended up doing most of the driving, so I was kind of a little bit fatigued yesterday. I took a day off, and today I'm recording the podcast, which is all good and groovy. As I said before, I'm doing a couple of episodes of The Outer Limits for this podcast. I was thinking about them a little bit. They popped up in somebody's Facebook feed. I thought, well, yeah, well, that'd be really good for the podcast, so I'll give them a go. And I found out that I did have them on disc. I got a lot of TV on discs, most of which, oddly enough, are actually legal. And we rewatched them and went, yeah, these two will be fine. Both of them written by Harlan Ellison, the science fiction slash fantasy writer who's been in the industry for about as long as I've been alive, and who now has a kind of slightly tarnished reputation as a curmudgeon and for some inappropriate acts he did a few years ago at a science fiction convention. You can look that up, so I'm not going to go into it. I will say, though, that if you get the opportunity to, you should read his two collections of essays, or well, any of his collections of essays, but in particular The Glass Teat and The Other Glass Teat, which were about television in the 1960s. They're fantastic, and I reread them every few years. And they're just really good, solid essays on how television was changing in the 1960s and how censorship was really having a strangling effect on the medium at the time. And, yeah, it's kind of written from right at that junction point
where the early 60s became a totally different America in the late 60s. And it's well worth seeing. In fact, any of the essay collections that Ellison did are worth checking out. But these two episodes of The Outer Limits are among the best of them. And I really enjoyed revisiting them, and I got more from them rewatching them than I had watching them previously. So what have I been watching since last I podcasted? To be honest with you, not a lot, because I've been doing real world stuff like cruising around to some fantastic restaurants with family and Gary de Gould's Book Arcade and going into Crave Coffee in Sydney and seeing how they roast the beans and all that and having a talk with Chris who runs that place. So, you know, just basically engaging with the planet a lot more, engaging with society and engaging with family. But I have watched two things, and I'm going to bring them up on my Letterboxd right now. Funnily enough, both of the movies were for the ABC local radio NT gig that I do, and they were quite different films in a way, but not too dissimilar. We did Local Hero, the Bill Forsyth film, which starred Peter Riegert and Burt Lancaster, from about mid-1980s, I think about 1984, so we had a bit of fun with that. Then Liz got to pick a movie for a nice change, and she picked Barefoot in the Park, the movie based on the Neil Simon play, starring very young Robert Redford and Jane Fonda. And she liked that more than I did, to be honest with you. I've got a few problems with it, particularly with the way the Jane Fonda character is presented in the early part of the film. But we talked around that, and it was good to kind of get outside my comfort zone and really discuss something that she liked, but I didn't particularly. So we had a little bit of a David and Margaret thing there. So they're pretty much all that I've been watching. I did watch a lot of children's TV when I was up in Sydney. We were staying with Linda and Gavin and Billy, and I ended up watching tons and tons of kiddie TV, none of which is particularly memorable, but we also did a lot of family stuff, really, which was kind of cool, and ate way too much good food, which is never a bad thing. Had a fish stew, which blew my head off. It was just the best food I've eaten probably in the last 20 years at a place called the Coogee Pavilion, which I recommend if you're in Sydney. Go to the Coogee Pavilion and get some fresh food there, because it is spectacularly good. So a little bit of a food porn kind of podcast this time, obviously, but yeah, I did eat well. So on with the two episodes. They are in order that they were broadcast and the order I'm going to do them in. Soldier, starring Michael Ansara and Lloyd Nolan, and Demon with a Glass Hand, starring Ali Martel and Robert Culp. So I'll just do the first one first and we'll get into that, and that is Soldier. I'll read you a little bit of a blurb from it, from a very valuable, in the sense of being a good reference book, book called The Outer Limits, The Official Companion by David J. Shaw and Jeffrey Frenzel. My copy of it's very dog-eared and battered. I really should try to find a newer copy of it, but I'll read a bit of their summary for the episode. On a blasted radioactive no man's land somewhere after the year 3000, foot soldier Klaalo Klobugny, and I said that badly, meets an enemy infantryman head-on in the middle of a crossfire of death beams. The energy propels both men backward in time to 1964, with the enemy stuck halfway between the present and the future. Carlo's materialization causes immediate urban panic, and he is apprehended after disintegrating a police car with his energy rifle. Kagan, a philologist, is summoned to decipher Carlo's gibberish and realizes that the soldier is speaking a form of English. He and the government liaison Paul Tanner deduce that Carlo was from the future, and while Tanner runs interference against other agencies eager to get their hands on him, Kagan patiently establishes a rapport with the man from the future.
Night comes too soon on the battlefield. For some men it comes permanently, their eyes never open to the light of day. But for this man, fighting this war, there is never total darkness. The spidery beams of light in the sky are the descendants of the modern laser beam. Heat rays that sear through tungsten steel and flesh as though they were cheesecloth. And this soldier must go against those weapons. His name is Carlo, and he is a foot soldier. the ultimate infantryman. Trained from birth by the state, he has never known love or closeness or warmth. He is geared for only one purpose, to kill the enemy. And the enemy waits for him.
Soldier's based on a short story that Harlan Ellison sold to Fantastic Universe Science Fiction in 1957. He got $91 for the story, and it ends, the ending of the story is a little bit different to the ending of the television episode. It was also Harlan Ellison's first science fiction sale to television, his first screenplay written for specifically a science fiction. He'd done a few other things. He'd done an episode of Ripcord. He'd also done an episode of Route 66, both of which were fairly popular shows at the time, but this was his first genre one. And he got $5,000 for doing it, which is not a bad little gig. The way the ending differs in the story is, and I won't tell you the ending from the TV episode, I'll let you find that out for yourself, but the ending of the story has Qualo going on a lecture tour to discuss the future and the problems of Armageddon and things like that as a kind of peace advocate, which is a kind of an interesting approach to it, but it wouldn't really play within the format limitations of an episodic TV series like The Outer Limits. Ellison also was in the army for a time, and I think the ending of his army service was around the same time the story was written, so it may have been a bit of a reaction to some quite unpleasant events and the fact that he wasn't a very good match for the military life. But to get to the story and to get to the teleplay, one of the problems I've got looking at this and reviewing it again is we're looking at it 50 years after it came out, and that presents a few problems in kind of reviewing it and analysing it to any extent. The problems are that if it was done these days, if the teleplay had to come up and been done in the second decade of the 21st century, it would have been totally different. There's so much history of science fiction genre that came after Soldier that you can kind of, even not really voluntarily but involuntarily, nitpick small details of it, which if it had been done now wouldn't have been a problem. But yeah, it's a kind of mental exercise to go back and not criticise it for the things it wasn't, but to appreciate it for the things it was. And that's probably one of the problems we have with older genre works of any kind, just that kind of the fact that we know so much more now and that we've seen certain things done so much better now due to technological advances, a more sophisticated audience, and the lifting of a lot of censorship problems that were present at the time that this TV episode came out. But I'll tell you the things that are really good about it. That's probably the approach to take on this. First off, Michael Ansara as Qualo is very, very good. Ansara was a Syrian-born American actor. He was married to Barbara Eden for a time, and they had a child together. He's really good in this. His body language fits the character, who's been raised basically as a soldier. He's a human weapon in a sense. And though he's not unintelligent, and you need a certain amount of intelligence, of course, to be an effective soldier, his experience is incredibly limited. One of the things that Kagan, the character played by Lloyd Nolan, finds out is that all of the soldiers are raised on what they call war islands, and they're decanted. They're not naturally born. They're basically manufactured people in tubes or something along those lines, and they're raised on war islands where they train and know nothing else besides war. And he plays that really, really well. He's a few of the interesting things about him is, one, he's got radiation scars on his cheek, which are one of the ways that they find out that he's not from around there when he comes back to the 20th century. He's got a really weird hairline with little kind of spikes of hair sticking down across his brow. And Sarah was going bald at the time, so it's obviously wig. And he's got a kind of really intense monobrow eyebrow, which again kind of takes him out of looking exactly like a 20th century human being. But Ansara is really good. He's the clipped way he talks in the episode is very effective. He's trained to communicate quickly and effectively. The character also has incredibly sensitive hearing, which is one of the problems he has coming back to the 20th century. And his helmet has sound baffles in it so that loud noises won't affect that. Obviously, there are advantages to having hypersensitive hearing if you're a soldier in certain circumstances, so they work that into there as well. I'll just play a nice little bit where Lloyd Nolan's Kagan is trying to understand the things that Qualo is saying and comes up with the reasons and the manner by which he says them.
Well?
Well, what?
7 days and you ask me, well, what?
He's a soldier.
Any more late bulletins? I spent 3 years in the Rangers, Kagan. I know a soldier when I see one.
No, I mean he is really a soldier. There's nothing about him that's not a soldier. He's the perfect ultimate infantry man. I don't think he knows anything else.
What makes you think that?
You know that gibberish he's been spelling?
Which is?
It's English.
English? Ah, come on, Kagan. The guy's obviously a foreigner of some kind.
It's a wrong word. Not foreigner. Try alien.
Alien? From another planet?
Now, wait a minute. You're rushing me.
Well, the department wants facts. They got men lined up just waiting for a crack at him. Sociologists, philosophers, physicists.
They feel you've had them long enough.
All right. You tell them not to press me.
You tell them I'm just beginning to break through. But he has to trust me implicitly first. Just one slip and we lose the whole game.
Hey. Take it easy, Tom.
Well, I guess I'm just pushed. It's like trying to hold on to fog. One moment you think you've got it, then the next moment it's gone. It's a very strange and peculiar item we have down there, but it is not a stupid one.
Okay. I'll do the best I can to run interference for you.
Oh, thanks.
I just wish you could give me something.
All right, I'll give you something. Do you want to know what he's saying over and over again without change? He's saying my name is Qualo Clobrigny. Private. R-M-E-N-T-N-D-O. His name, his rank, and his serial letters.
Name's Qualo Clobrigny, private. R-M-E-N-T-N-D-O.
So Kagan convinces the authorities to allow Qualo to go and live in his house with his family. He's got a very kind of nuclear family, a wife, a son, and a daughter. And Qualo does do that. He does, unfortunately, have the problem of the enemy still out there, and the enemy's kind of stuck between the past and the future, and eventually breaks free into the 20th century and comes looking for Qualo, and that leads to the end of the story. Now, there's a couple of really nice effective bits of special effects in this little teleplay as well. There's a scene where the enemy burns down one of the walls of Kagan's house, and that's done really well with physical effects, not with any kind of imposed effects. And I think it's really cool. There's also the interactions that Qualo has with the cat, which ultimately does help right at the end of the piece to alert him to the danger of the enemy. Now, the enemy is played by an actor called Alan Jaffe, who did a few things. He was in The Warlord with Charlton Heston. And one of the differentiation points, they're both dressed identically with the kind of spaceman helmets and the backpacks and the gear. They both, in uniform, both Qualo and the enemy, look like they stepped out of a 1950s pulp science fiction cover. But the enemy doesn't have an eyebrow, which makes it kind of interesting, the fact that they, whether deliberately or not, and Alan Jaffe didn't have much in the way of eyebrows, whether they deliberately chose to make that differentiation between the two, when ultimately they're very much a similar kind of character. They're both being ordered to kill by their headphones in their helmets. They both dress fairly identically. It's a bit hard to tell how they differentiated the two on the battlefield. I mean, usually there's a bit of a difference in the uniforms, but these guys are dressed almost identically. But, Alan Jaffe doesn't get much to say at all and doesn't really get to do much apart from writhing around, stuck between the past and the future, and then ultimately attacking Qualo in the Kagan's house. Now, Harlan Ellison originally did this a lot differently. There were a lot of scenes that he had to kind of change for budgetary reasons. Originally, Qualo appeared in a subway and was deafened by the sound of a subway car going past. And there are also a number of other things in there. There's a scene towards the end where Qualo breaks into a sporting goods store to get a rifle. And that was another scene imposed by the production company, the studios, to try to give a bit more action to the piece, which is kind of stupid in a sense that there's plenty to engage the mind in this piece without having that very unnecessary scene with the sporting goods store where the cops bail up Qualo and he's hiding in there with a rifle and Kagan's got to come in and get him. So that kind of seemed unnecessary because this is, more than anything else, this is kind of a puzzle piece. They've got scientists and authorities, the scientists being represented by Lloyd Nolan's philologist, who are trying to find out who this guy is, where he came from, and what to do with him as well. And that's an engaging enough premise for pretty much anybody. You don't need to have a lot of action scenes to convey that. Ellison's script is very intelligent. It's well thought out. The future technology is really interesting. They find Qualo's ray gun and find out that it's got an unlimited power supply and has three moving parts in it, and that's very impressed the authorities. The problem, there's a couple of loose ends at the end of this piece, and one of them is the fact that Qualo's weapon stays in the 20th century, and eventually somebody somehow is going to find a way to reverse engineer it, which brings up some scary possibilities. Now, were this a Twilight Zone episode, I think it would have been done very differently. Outer Limits didn't really preach as much as Twilight Zone often did under the watchful eye of Rod Serling. And they don't really go into overemphasizing the war is bad and all of that kind of thing. They're trying to help a single individual in this. It's a much more focused humanism in this one, where Kagan and is trying to help one person, being Qualo, rather than kind of going into a much longer ramble about how bad authoritarianism is, how bad fascism is, how bad it is to have a perpetual war, how bad it is to train people and breed people as soldiers. None of that really does get addressed very much there. It's more focused on the individual and whether Qualo as a human being is redeemable. Doesn't end particularly on, it ends on an ambiguous note with that, but there are a couple of indications to say that, yes, he can be redeemed as a human being, but with the enemy attacking, he isn't given the opportunity to do so. And I think that's a lot of Twilight Zone these days. If you rewatch a lot of the early Twilight Zone episodes, I'm not talking about any 1980s reboots, though. In fact, both Twilight Zone and Outer Limits did get a reboot in the 80s and 90s. If you go back to the originals, Twilight Zone can come across as very, very preachy. The Onion AV Club, in fact, has been doing a retrospective on a lot of Twilight Zone episodes, and they're kind of pointing out those weaknesses in them where they do kind of over-egg the pudding a lot when they're trying to make their moral point. Sometimes when you're making a moral point in a movie or in a TV show, you can't point every finger towards it. You've got to let the audience find it rather than steering them heavily towards it, I think. And Twilight Zone always had that overemphasis on morality, and sometimes misguidedly. I mean, some of the moral things in Twilight Zone episodes are really misguided and badly thought out. But of course, you got to remember that they're doing episodic TV on a weekly basis, and they really didn't have a lot of time to kind of think things through as much as you'd like them to do at times. But I've been watching a few Outer Limits episodes since I watched the two for this podcast. And there is some really good acting, and there's some subtle philosophical stuff in a lot of these episodes, which is kind of cool. It's not, it doesn't draw attention to itself the way a lot of Twilight Zones do, but it's there. And I do like that. I also like the fact that, like Twilight Zone, a lot of the actors used in the Outer Limits episodes were people who were blacklisted in the 1950s by the McCarthy and the House Un-American Activities Committee and all that kind of nasty shit that was going on at that stage. They were blacklisted actors, and they've now shown how stupid and how much of a loss to American cinema and American television it was to blacklist these people. People like Jeff Corey, Howard De Silver, a bunch of other actors like that really shine in these kind of genre works. And you've got to remember, genre was marginalized at the time. It wasn't the mainstream thing it is now. And these guys really did show that they were the best of the best in some cases at the acting gig. Of course, a lot of them went back to do stage work in New York mostly and kind of refined their talents in doing that. But just to wind up on Soldier, Harlan Ellison did sue James Cameron, amongst other people, for stealing some of the tropes from his teleplay and from this particular episode for the Terminator movies. There was an undisclosed settlement made and a new little line put into the credits acknowledging Harlan Ellison's contribution to the Terminator. But again, I mean, the movie Soldier with Kurt Russell owes a little bit to this one as well, less so than I think the Terminator. But again, you can always argue the point on whether the lawsuits that Harlan Ellison put out were valid or not. For me, I'm not a lawyer. I think that an acknowledgement that and a cash payment seemed to be right for the Terminator stuff. But Harlan Ellison is an unusual character in the world of genre. I've had the honour of meeting him twice, once at a convention and once at a private kind of gig for the Nova Mob, a science fiction discussion group. This was back in the 1980s. I acted like a dick both times because when you meet somebody whose work you admire, you can go two ways. You can get shy or you can be a dick trying to impress them. And I was a dick both times. I'll be really honest about that. And had I the opportunity again to have those times over, I think I'd act very, very differently. I wasn't always a nice person particularly, and I wasn't always a cool person at all. But Ellison's work, leaving aside, as I said, his later peccadilloes and his later foibles, as he becomes quite an elderly man who was born, he's heading towards, I think he's 80 this year. And I think that he's maybe suffering from relevance deprivation syndrome a little bit. There are some YouTube videos of him ranting and raving and being the curmudgeon. But I think that he's not really attacking the big targets. He's kind of shooting fish in a barrel there. But in his day, Ellison was among the best of the best, and we really got to acknowledge that. But, of course, in this 21st century new media age, it's the stupid thing you did today that matters, not the 100 really impressive things you did 30, 40, 50 years ago. But anyway, I'm going to take a break now. I want to get back and talk about the second of the Harlan Ellison Outer Limits episodes, being Demon with a Glass Hand, starring Robert Culp and Ali Martel.
Talking about chicken and rice, all of those dishes are mighty nice. Gather around, you girls, and listen to me. I want to tell you about my baby's recipe. I like my baby's pudding. I like it best of all. I like my baby's pudding. I like it best of all. There's a gal named Miss Fanny Brown. She cooks the best gumbo in this town. All of you chicks can really cook, but Fanny Brown's learned something you don't learn in the books. I like my baby's pudding. I like it best of all. I like my baby's pudding. I like it best of all. 99 times I've tried to eat all those fine fancy cuts of country meat. Just can't eat a single bite. I just don't have the appetite. I like my baby's pudding. I like it best of all. I like my baby's pudding. I like it best of all. Well, she promised me she wouldn't give no one a pudding but me. Yeah, she promised me she wouldn't give no one a pudding but me. But I don't believe her, I'll just have to wait and see. Gonna watch my baby both night and day, so she won't give my pudding away. My baby's pudding is all she owns, so there ain't no meat for Henry Jones. I like my baby's pudding, I like it best of all. I like my baby's pudding, I like it best of all. I like my baby's pudding, I like it best of all. I like my baby's pudding, I like it best of all.
That was Wynonie Harris with I Like My Baby's Pudding, which may or may not be about food porn, or may not be about sexual jealousy.
You come from the Earth 1,000 years in the future. The Kyvan came from the stars, and man had no defense against them. They conquered the planet Earth in a month. But before they could slaughter the millions of humans left, overnight, without warning, without explanation, every man, woman, and child of Earth vanished. You were the only one left, Mr. Trent. With a glass hand, the vanished Earthman had given you to help you. They called you the last hope of humanity. The medallion you stole let you escape into now, the present, today. And now you are among all the men of Earth who are alive today. But the Kyvan gained possession of three parts of your hand. The computer that could answer all the questions. You have to get those three lobes to me, the computer brain, and find out what the alien Kyvan really want from you. Why you were the only man left alive 1,000 years in the future on the planet Earth.
So we're on to Demon with a Glass Hand, the second of Harlan Ellison's Outer Limits scripts, and both of them deal with time travel in their own way, the first one, of course, being accidental, and this one being deliberate with the Kyvan aliens coming back in time to try to capture Trent, the character played by Robert Culp, who has the secret of why the human race, 1,000 years in the future, went missing when the Kyvans invaded the Earth. All of them just suddenly disappeared. Nobody knows where they are except Trent. And even Trent doesn't know where they are because the information on where they are is hidden on one of the missing fingers of his glass hand. Ellison said originally about the script that he wanted this to be his homage to North by Northwest. He wanted to make it a chase movie in a linear and lateral kind of way. But there were, of course, budgetary limitations, this being episodic TV in 1964. And so he decided that he was going to do a vertical chase through a building. And they went to the Bradbury Building in Los Angeles, which apparently now, according to my sources, holds the internal investigations area of the Los Angeles Police Department. It's a great old building. Apparently it was designed by a very eccentric architect. The lifts were hydraulic. They're actually done with columns of water, or at least they were at the time this was filmed, 50 years ago. And it's got a unique look. You've seen it in any number of films. There are a whole bunch of different ones, Blade Runner included. There was one very late Charles Bronson movie, which also is featured heavily in the Bradbury Building. It's got that kind of iconic look about it. And Trent does travel from the basement of the building, in fact from the sewers of the building, all the way up to the highest level of it in his chase to stop the Kyvan and retrieve the missing fingers, some of which are held in the future, and he's got to kind of convince them to bring them into the past, and some of them are on site. The Kyvan have surrounded the building with a force field so he can't get out, and he also meets a woman who's kind of working overtime on the small business she had with her late husband, and her name is Consuela Biros, and she's played by Arlene Martella, an actress who died this year, in fact. And Ellison was really fighting to make her character Hispanic American, but people, the producers and that, really didn't want to make an issue of that. This was 1964. They really weren't as hip to multiracial casting as they are now. And so they argued the fact, they gave her a kind of generic surname of Biros, which is kind of vaguely European and nonspecific, but Ali Martel played it as a Hispanic American, and that's kind of cool too. I think she's quite strong in this, even though she's a secondary character, and even though she is anti-violence and really doesn't approve of what Trent's doing until she understands it fully. She's a nice, strong piece of acting, as is Robert Culp as Trent. Robert Culp, of course, this was just before he got the gig in I Spy. He'd done a few TV series, a few Western TV series and a few other bits, and he was an up-and-coming actor. He did a little bit of stuff for MGM, movies like Sunday in New York he was in, and was kind of an up-and-coming star at the time. People mostly know him these days for The Greatest American Hero, but he did do stuff before that. He also wrote a lot of good essays. He wrote a very, very good essay, if you can find it online, about the westerns of John Ford, which is incredibly perceptive, and I'm incredibly envious of his perception when it comes to movies. Unfortunately, he died a couple of years ago, as you know. But in this one, he's really great. He uses the physicality that he brought to I Spy and other things he did. And his Trent really is a kind of, in a sense, he's an amnesiac character at the start of the thing. But he brings a kind of intensity to it and that kind of an intelligence to the role, which is kind of rare in that kind of episodic TV. Played by other actors, it may not have been nuanced as it was played by Culp. In fact, when he was writing the script, Ellison was asked to write for a specific actor, and he picked Robert Culp and wrote the script for him, which always makes it a lot stronger for some reason. When a writer can specifically angle a script to an actor. It was directed by Byron Haskin, who directed a whole bunch of cool stuff. He did a lot of stuff with George Pell. In fact, a couple of years after this, he did The Power, which I've talked about on the Martian Drive-In podcast, before George Pell, who produced it. He also directed really cool things like The Naked Jungle with Charlton Heston and Eleanor Powell, about all the soldier ants and things like that. He wasn't a kind of A-grade director, but he was a good, honest B-grade director in my book. And in this one, too, they really do some interesting things, as did a lot of Outer Limits episodes. They use shadow really well. They kind of give it a knock. I mean, every time the shadow is used well in a black and white format, people name check and reference film noir, but that's not the case in this one. It's a good, it goes further back than film noir. It kind of harks back in some ways to Cabinet of Dr. Caligari and that kind of chiaroscuro used in that kind of thing, and all the Ufa people who came out of German silent cinema and all took a hike when Hitler came in. It's got a lot of that kind of thing in it, and the Bradbury building as a location really does lend itself well to that kind of deep shadow, deep focus, black and white photography that they use really well in this. And there are also some unusual camera angles, not just Dutch angles in this one, but a lot of things shot from on high, looking down at the characters, low looking up at them. They really do vary things up a lot to make the setting more interesting. And in fact, the setting is one of the characters. Now, the Kyber aliens aren't particularly well done, and they're a little uneven in a number of ways. They all kind of wear jumpsuits, and they've got what look like bathing caps on their heads and deep circles painted around their eyes to make them not look human. It's said that the Kyber are trying to look like humans. They've been changed to look like humans. And there's limitations, budgetary limitations, again, making this kind of television. So all you've got to do is make them look weird to make them look alien. And some of them had kind of cheesclothy masks over their faces. Other ones didn't. So that's a little uneven there too. Abraham Surfer plays Arch, who's ostensibly the leader of the group, but the character's not very strongly written. And the overwhelming sense of it is Trent fighting a whole bunch of Kyber who can only come through the time mirror two at a time, so that limits the number of them they can send through. They can't flood him with 150 warriors all at once. And the way that he gets them to, rather than killing them and turning it into a gore fest, each one of them wears a medallion around their neck to keep them in our time. So that when Trent removes that medallion from their neck, they're wrenched back into the future and killed, basically, by the slingshot effect of going back into the future. Which also brings up the non-violence of Consuelo, the character. There's a time when she pulls off one of the medallions from one of the Kyben to save Trent's life and kind of has to live with the fact that she's committed a violent and essentially a murderous act to try to help somebody. So her whole philosophy of non-violence is challenged by the reality within a TV thing of what she's doing, and that's kind of good. They gave her an arc that didn't just make her a screaming, running around woman. She had a moral stance which was challenged by what occurred, and she faced that change in circumstances and the way that it's changed the way she sees the world and the necessity of killing openly. In a sense, she is a strong character in there. She's running a business by herself. Her husband was killed in some sort of violence not long before, and she's romantically attracted to Trent because he's played by Robert Culp and he does cool things and that kind of stuff. And she does admit, even under the short acquaintance that they have, that she might be falling in love with him, which is kind of one of those television things where you compress time a lot and things happen that wouldn't happen that way in real life. But Alain Martel is very good in this. But again, you come back to Culp and come back to the kind of, in a sense, the bottle TV episode. It's all set in one location, but it has cosmic consequences as well. What's happened to the human race, who 70 billion of them disappeared on one day after the Kyben invasion? And that's where the plot thing is. How is Trent involved with them? How did Trent get back? How did Trent get the glass hand? Why does Trent need to stay alive? And I'm not going to do spoilers on it. Even though it's 50 years old, if you haven't seen it, check it out. It's not hard to get a copy of this. And it is good science fiction television. I mean, the first one, of course, was mind-blowingly strong for its time. I keep going back to things like Twilight Zone and Outer Limits. I'm impressed with the fact that they really did try to do the genre right in a lot of cases. They didn't always succeed. Some of the producers and what they now call line producers didn't really get the genre very much, but they had a keen eye for what the public would like. But behind them, there were a whole bunch of really skilled technicians as well. There were people who had done movies for the last 30, 40 years who came in and directed and were the cinematographers and the lighting technicians and all those back-of-house guys who kind of went to episodic television when the studio system started collapsing in the 1950s and people on long-term contracts were given the sack because television was then threatening cinema production, according to the people making movies. And they started making a lot of really large movies and a lot of really cheap movies, but nothing really in the middle. So Hollywood and Los Angeles were full of these people who had incredible technical skills who then went and did jobs on episodic television. You can see it in a whole bunch of different things. You can see it in episodes of Route 66. You can see it in the westerns they did on television, Have Gun, Will Travel, and all of those ones. And you can particularly see it in these genre TV series where they really did lift the material a lot higher than it would have been had they not been involved. And I kind of like that. I like the fact that these people did have at least a job. And some of their later work is available for us to look at. Even people like Jack Arnold, who did all of the B-movie horror movies, monster movies in the 1950s, Creature from the Black Lagoon, Tarantula, and all those sorts of things. You'll see his work in episodic television in the 1960s and into the early 1970s as well. And he didn't get respect for what he did until well after he died. But, again, that respect eventually did come as people were able to watch these things in repeatable formats like VHS and DVD and online and things like that, and were able to see the quality of what was being done. And that's the case with this one too. It's a small, tight little less than 1 hour, 51 minutes of television, which kind of tells a cosmic story. The backstory is the invasion of Earth and the destruction of Earth by aliens, and the total disappearance of the human race, and then a radioactive plague. I'm not sure what a radioactive plague is. It doesn't make scientific sense. But a radioactive plague is put across the Earth to kill the invaders, and the half-life of that plague is 50 years. So it's going to be a long time before the human race, if they ever do reappear, can repopulate the Earth after they've killed off the Kyber invaders. So there's an enormous backstory in this TV episode, which is set in one building, really. And that's kind of interesting. And this is, and also you've got to remember that things like this are the stuff that inspired the people that made all of the science fiction movies of the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, the 2000s, and into our decade as well. This is inspirational stuff. This shows them the theater of the imagination, the fact that even with a small budget and even with incredible limitations imposed by censorship and studios and studio producers and things like that, you can still make compelling and interesting and thought-provoking science fiction on screen in the 1960s, 50 years ago, half a century ago. They were making really groovy and cool stuff. Now, if it was made now, it would be done totally differently. There'd be a lot more. It wouldn't be done in one building. They would have had the chase aspect of it as well. Budgets are much larger now. You've got CGI to play with. You've got 50 years more knowledge of how science fiction works on the screen as a genre. And you've got literally thousands of examples of it to call on and to homage and to use as an influence. But this is very early days. TV was only about 20 years old, maybe a little more. England had it before the war to a certain limited extent, but it was an incredibly new format for watching things. Movies themselves, as I keep repeating in various podcasts, are still a young art form. They're only a bit over a century old, 120 years old. And I always get a great joy from seeing early examples of things that are now incredibly large and incredibly popular. Kind of like the way that you'd watch the old Adventures of Superman TV series and see a continuum between that and all of the great big Marvel and DC blockbusters of our decade. There are baby steps towards the stuff that we have now. And I think that these two examples of The Outer Limits with Harlan Ellison's input really do show that. They show that on a small scale you can tell really big stories. It's all in the writing, it's all in the acting, which in both cases is superb, though in the first one, Lloyd Nolan playing Kagan was a little shouty and over the top, but that was basically because the man was deaf and didn't tell anybody. But I've got a hell of a lot of respect and a lot of love for these things because of that. The fact that somebody took a chance on them in the studios. Our producer put the package together, Rod Serling in the case of Twilight Zone and Joseph Stefano in the case of The Outer Limits. And they put together something that's lasted through time. Looking at these things again 50 years later, I've watched about 7 or 8 episodes of them now in the last week or so. I've got a lot of respect from them. There are a couple that are silly. There are special effects that are very ropey and almost ludicrous these days. But I do come back to the fact that there's some good acting in these episodes. And I think one of the things I'm learning, and of course everybody's still learning every time they watch things, is that really good acting can lift shitty material a lot better than good special effects can lift shitty material if the acting's crap. The people involved are crucial to this. The writing, of course, is enormous help, but a good actor can kind of soften the edges of bad writing. And in these episodes, there is good acting and there are people that really did take care, even within the short timelines, to tell the stories well and to make everything work really well for the audience. And all respect to them for that. And that's one of the reasons why I get to be a little bit of an apologist for Harlan Ellison. I don't think a lot of the things he does now are right or even sane at times. but I've got a lot of respect for his body of work and for he did a lot of civil rights stuff. He basically dissected 1960s television like nobody else has done ever since with any decade of television. In The Glass Teat and The Other Glass Teat, those two collections, which are hard to find now, but they're worth finding. Really, find his stuff, his television writers from the 60s, 70s and 80s, if you can, because they are valuable stuff. And they do, even when you disagree with them, have a perception that is lacking from a lot of television and movie criticism these days. So I'll do a checklist on the things you should try to find. Try to find Harlan Ellison's Watching. That's a collection. I've got a hardcover of it up in my newly renovated corner of the man cave, and I'm just trying to spot it on the shelf now. Yep, got it. There's also the two Glass Teat ones. An Edge in My Voice is also good. Anything like that. Ellison's perception on genre works is really an important one. So that's about it for those two episodes. I'm going to take another break now, and when I get back, I'm going to do some feedback, and we've actually got a voicemail. Ta-da!
I was born 10 days ago. A full-grown man born 10 days ago. I woke on a street of this city. I don't know who I am or where I've been or where I'm going. Someone wiped my memories clean. And they tracked me down and tried to kill me. Why? Who are you? I ran. I managed to escape them the first time. Then the hand, my hand, told me what to do. What could I do? Who are they?
Programming data insufficient on question two. Who are they? Random collation of possibilities. Question one, what can I do? In order of factors of success are as follows. A, each pursuer wears a gold medallion. Remove these medallions. B, the time mirror permits only two travelers at one time, but they are replenishable. If possible, destroy the mirror. C, stay alive. Above all, stay alive. Destiny is in your whole hand. D, I am incomplete. I can serve you better if I am complete.
Okay, news from the planet Mars first, and I've got one tiny brief snippet of news from the planet Mars for you, and it comes in the form of a Facebook meme, which is pretty cool. And the Facebook meme says this: Mars is the only planet we know of entirely populated by robots. So I thought I'd just leave you with that one and get on with the feedback. The feedback we've got is from Rich Palmer over at the Rotcast, and he disagrees with me about Dark City, the fact that I said that there were certain flaws with Dark City as a movie. And here's what Rich had to say about it, and I'll address it after Rich has his say.
Hello, Terry. This is your friend Rich at Rotcast Podcast. I haven't done a show lately, but if I did, I would dedicate it to refuting your take on Dark City. I don't know what's going on there. I mean, it's true, it's your podcast, and you can have that opinion, but I want to put before you a couple of ideas that may refute some of the points you've made about Dark City. Okay, let's start with, it's not a film noir. Or a neo-noir, you cannot dispute the fact that it has elements of film noir and is nostalgic for film noir. In the set design, there's nostalgia. Some of the cars and fashions look like they're from the 30s or 40s. I believe the commentary track on the movie suggests that they weren't trying to depict any certain era, but many different eras. The nightclub singing and the police, there's that element of it. Dark City ends sort of on an upbeat note. Not all film noirs ended tragically. There's several that I enjoy that have happy endings. I think one's I Wake Up Screaming and another is His Kind of Woman. You should check those out. They're definitely film noirs and happy Hollywood fashion. Also, what if you look at Dark City, not from the hero and heroine's point of view, but from the alien's point of view, or Dr. Schreiber's point of view? They are trapped and they are doomed, and those are elements of film noir. Let's talk about the acting. The acting's fine. You go on about how it's downplayed the emotional range, but again, not all emotion has to go across someone's face, although the actors are doing fine in that regard. Some of the emotions are built into their actions. So take the actions of the aliens. They want to survive, so they are curious about their test subjects. They are also aggressive, and they overreact when they lose control, and they hunt and stalk their prey. They are controlling, I said, and they are devious. They're using trickery to keep the test subjects unaware of what's going on. And they are also kind of sadistic. They like to inflict pain. So all of that, they're trying to be blank like aliens. All of those emotional triggers are there in their actions. Now, for the test subjects, I'm going to call them test subjects because although they look like us, this story doesn't describe them as human beings. They could look like us just for our better empathy with them. The test subjects act mostly afraid and confused the majority of the film, and our hero gets angry at the end. I think the film is very well paced. I don't know what you're talking about when you say there's a lull in the middle, although many movies do have a lull in the middle. This movie changes basically from a mystery into a more action-y adventure with them flying around and having a big fight. The visuals in this are pretty astounding most of the times. Comparing them to The Matrix, and The Matrix visuals are also very good. I think at least early on in Dark City, the Proyas is more poetic with his visuals than a lot of the Matrix films are, although in the beginning of The Matrix, where you can really see that the sets, they reuse the sets, you said, in The Matrix. I wasn't aware of that, but you can really see the similarity of in the night scenes with Trinity. Troyes is a little more poetic. Think about the goldfish in the tub and the zoom in on the hotel, and just about everything at the beginning of this is very poetic and dreamlike, and that's appropriate. Okay, the love story. There's not much of a love story here. You could say it's cardboard, but it is actually only used in short pieces. There's no doubt that these two could not love each other. It's just not realistic that they, within the story, they can't. But the way they are acting, because they're basically programmed, shows that they have a capacity for this. And then I just want to jump to the ending. Now, if this ended with them like running towards each other and embracing, and there being this great love between them, that would have ruined everything that went before. But they don't. They just meet as strangers on a pier, and you are left to gather that they might end up together. What I really like about this film, and what I think gives it, you'd be able to watch it over and over again, is the questions that it doesn't answer. You talked about the reveal. Well, there's not a much revealed, really. We don't know anything about the test subjects in this. Like I said, they might be human, but I'm not even sure that they're alive. The aliens are using dead bodies. So these people we're looking at might also be dead bodies, just autonomous. rather than having a creature living inside them. The sun comes out and we assume that they're going to have a much better life. But what does that mean? I don't think that any children are shown in the film. Are they going to continue on? And is the god that Rufus Sewell has become going to make this into a real world? I guess that is all implied, but we really don't know where they come from and where they're going. And I think just contemplating that is worth watching it over and over again. Also, I think you said that basically that the Matrix has bigger, better intellectual ideas going on within it, as well as better action. I agree that there are more ideas in the Matrix, and they are very more delineated, pronounced than in Dark City. I think I prefer Dark City in some ways because you have to dig out what you have to get your own meaning out of a lot of it. And I mean, if you want to spend the time, when in The Matrix, they almost need footnotes and say, here, go out from this movie and find the philosophy that it's based on, which is, you know, not something I'm going to do. There's lots of room for debate in this one. I'm glad you disliked it because that gives me more chance to talk about the good parts about Dark City. I'll keep listening. Bye.
Hey, thanks, Rich. I don't mind disagreement, and it's good that you're still listening, and it's good that you disagree with that. But I'll address a couple of points. I don't want to rip down all of your arguments particularly. You said that it's got the 1930s and 1940s cars and buildings, so it kind of gives it a film noir feel about it. It could also give a feel of a Busby Berkeley musical. It could also give a feel of a gangster film as well. The wallpaper doesn't make the film noir thing. With film noir, you've got to have that sense of despair. And you've got to have that sense of fate and inevitability. Yes, there were some films noir, that had happy Hollywood endings. I'll totally admit that. But the good ones don't particularly. The good ones, like Detour and things like that, have that kind of darkness at the end of it and that kind of fatalism, that inevitability and that noirishness that this one doesn't have. It's basically got the wallpaper, but it doesn't have the furniture of film noir, from my point of view. But we can agree to disagree on that one. Looking at things from the aliens' point of view, and I just did. I did my best, right? They created this enormous environment of a city and populated it with people and did experiments on them because they were looking for a new home or whatever they were doing. Basically, why? If they need to find a new home, the fact that they can build a fucking great city in space tells me they don't need a planet. Planets are a pain in the ass. Planets, you've got to get in and out of the gravity well. You're at the fate of volcanism. You're at the fate of hurricanes and winds and climate change and all sorts of other shit. You're much better off staying in space and just building spaceships and space colonies because it's a lot less hassle and you can move them around a lot. So basically, the problem with these aliens isn't the fact that they're looking for a new home and they're dying out or anything like that. It's the fact that they're fucking stupid. And they really do need to kind of rethink their initial premise. A lot of science fiction does this as well. It's like, you know, aliens come to Earth to take our water from us. Well, if they want water, the easiest way to get water is basically mine Europa, mine the rings of Saturn, mine the Oort cloud, which is full of comets that are basically dirty water and rocks. Why the fuck would you come to Earth to get water from our planet and take it to another planet when every known piece of space has got fucking great chunks of ice floating through it? Yeah, they're spaced pretty far apart, but it's a lot easier than invading a planet to get a chunk of ice from an asteroid. So why would you bother? See, that's kind of things in science fiction movies piss me off. They don't think through the premise. And there's no real reason for an alien to invade a planet in another solar system, really. Yeah, you can harvest a few people and grab a bit of DNA and clone yourself some chops or some steaks if you want to. But there's not really a good reason to invade another planet over those distances. There's no economic reason to do it. Charlie Stross had to bend all sorts of things to get the economics to work in Saturn's children. For an interstellar empire, let alone an invasion fleet. So even though this is a common science fiction trope, the alien invasion stuff, it really doesn't kind of have legs to it, except in the case of non-intelligent aliens, aliens that spread like viruses. You know, they come in, they drop into the atmosphere, they take over the planet, they start spawning again, and then they go elsewhere. Those kind of things, with no economic system behind them, but just a kind of compulsion to reproduce. Yeah, I can buy that kind of an alien invasion. But intelligent ones who want to get something that only Earth has, it's always bullshit. But, yeah, we can disagree about that. I really do think that one of the ways that this kind of movie works when it works well is to have likable characters, and is to have characters that you can appreciate and who you can kind of piggyback along with. And I don't think The Dark City has that. Yeah, visually it looks stunning. There's a whole bunch of those kind of facile virtues about the movie, but I don't think it really pays off as far as a people story is concerned or as part of an interesting narrative is concerned. It's very much, I mean, a movie like The 13th Floor, the one that had Gretchen Mol in it and Vincent D'Onofrio, that one has quite a similar story arc, even though it's about virtual reality, as this one has. But I think it has a better human story than Dark City. In fact, I should do The 13th Floor. That's an interesting film. I'm going to add it to the list. But anyway, Rich, thank you for your long explanation of why you defended Dark City. Fully appreciate where you're coming from, even while I disagree. And you should start podcasting again if you haven't done one for a while. It's fun and it keeps you off the streets and people like it. So anyway, that's about it for the feedback this time around. Thank you very much, Rich. And that's it for the podcast. I'll be back in a week with another Paleo Cinema podcast and in 2 weeks with another Martian Drive-In podcast. In the meantime, look after yourselves, take care, talk to your friends if you're feeling down, and keep watching the skies. And once again, it's time to thank all of the Patreon podcast subscribers. And here are the credits in the style of movie credits. I'd like to thank Alyssa, the location scout, Tansy, the Foley artist, Miss Jane, the wardrobe mistress, Christopher, the gaffer, Chris, the camera operator, Julia, the casting director, Jane, the dialect coach, Gary, the prop master, Morris, the musical director, Armin, the key grip, Tom, the focus puller, Sarah, the special effects director, Ian, the caterer, Grant, the technicolor consultant, Matt-O-Matic, the rattlesnake wrangler, and our new one, Elaine, the scientific advisor. And I'd also like to thank Sally. She's the assistant to Mr. Frost. Thanks to all of the subscribers. And the music in the background you're hearing is Claude Debussy playing Gollywog's Cakewalk from a piano roll of his.